At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. American democracy today. The Bush dynasty. The Bush dynasty is in the White House, and their rise to power has been paved by good birth and better business connections. Think Andover and Yale. Think Enron. But the Bush family is only the most visible manifestation of a troubling fact at the heart of American government. The extraordinary concentration of wealth in the hands of the top 1% of richest Americans is having a disturbing effect on our democracy. That's the view of Kevin Phillips, one-time political analyst in the Nixon White House, and today one of our country's most eloquent political writers. His new book, Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich, traces the long-standing conflict between our founding democratic ideals and the corrupting power of American business on them. On Point listeners, is concentrated wealth the enemy of democracy? How important is money, position, and a good family name in politics today? Are our politics becoming dynastic as a result? And how can you firewall the democratic process from the intimidating power of big business? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from his home in Litchfield, Connecticut, is Kevin Phillips. Good evening, Kevin.
Good evening.
Let's just pick up your argument. It's not unheard of in free market capitalist societies for wealth to accrue into the hands of the few. So how is the present concentration of wealth different, and how is its destabilizing effect on American democracy different today than it might have been 100 years ago?
Well, actually, taking 100 years ago, there's some parallel. Now, if we take the late 19th century, the so-called Gilded Age, the period during which you had an amazing surge of wealth connected to the industrialization of the United States, railroads, steel, oil. If you compare the 80s and 90s to that, you find really the one parallel. The healthier periods of American democracy did not see anything resembling the concentration that we produced in the 1980s and 90s, and therein lies the problem. The dangers in wealth concentration come when there have been a decade or two of events in which the stock market and business concentration and wealth momentum just goes ballistic. And this happened during the Gilded Age, and it happened during the 1980s and 90s. And when this happens, when wealth is getting bigger and bigger and its lead over the ordinary person is just growing enormously, it develops a hubris. And one of the things I try to do in the book is talk about the three corruptions that you see during these periods. We did in the Gilded Age, and we certainly did in the 80s and 90s. And the first corruption is financial. And this is the sort of gimmickry and Ponzi scheming and general swindling and fraud that's just in the newspapers and on broadcast media every day now. The second is political, and this is the extent to which money tries to take over politics, runs up the cost of elections, the politicians become dependent on needing cash, and essentially they listen to the viewpoints of those who write the checks. The third form of corruption that's attendant on one of these big build-ups, these great waves of momentum, is a kind of ideological re-scripting of the way Americans think. And in the Gilded Age, it came from social Darwinism, the notion of survival of the fittest, how the great capitalists were the Tyrannosaurus Rex of the era, and the ordinary person who didn't count didn't deserve anything because he or she wasn't a fittest example surviving. Now, you can't say that the 80s and the 90s were as bad as that, but some of the notions that everything should be done by markets, that globalization is good automatically, a market, a survival process, no matter what the effect on ordinary people or local statutes or what have you, there's been quite a reversion to that type of thinking. But last but not least, the notion that we had to get rid of the inheritance tax because it was really a death tax, and the acceptance by a number of Democrats of this type of wording. So it's extraordinary to me how much really the 80s and 90s have repeated of the enormous money culture and corruption that had to be dealt with 100 years ago. It needs it again.
Yeah, but now the other thing that you throw into to the argument is the notion that we're becoming dynastic.
Well, that's something new. I don't think that you could find the Harrisons and the Adamses back in the 19th century, but nothing akin to what we've had. And the two pegs to hang that particular hat on, first and most obvious, in contrast to John Quincy Adams, who was 24 years coming into the White House after his father and under the banner of a different party, George W. Bush has come in with only one intervening president of the other party succeeding his father in the obviously Republican and Republican. So that's something in itself. To me, it's sort of like the restoration of the Stuarts in 17th century England. You thought the Stuarts were awful when you got rid of them, but after a decade and a half of Cromwell and the Parliamentarians, people wanted a change, and they went back to the ones that they'd gotten rid of years earlier and thought it was a good idea. I think that after Clinton, enough people wanted to see the Bushes back that it was possible just to take.
Of course, you're talking on public radio now, Kevin, and there's enough people listening now who would say that the Bushes didn't actually win that election.
Well, that's true.
And that it, in fact, you know, close as it was, that the nation probably by a whisker would have preferred to see a continuation of at least the policies of the administration, the Clinton administration, if not necessarily Clinton himself.
Well, that's possible. But in terms of whether you should have even had George W. be in the ballpark after 8 years of what seemed to be pretty good prosperity, and granted there was a cloud drifting across the economic horizon in 2000, but to me it's impossible to imagine that George W. would have been the nominee if circumstances, and they certainly included a disillusionment with Bill Clinton, if those circumstances hadn't created a desire to sort of revert back and get a different type of morality. I think clearly on the moral side, the Democrats had a significant weakness.
Okay, well, that all politics is local, and contemporary political history is probably local as well. I'll come back to the present situation in a bit, but can we go back to the beginning of the nation? Wealth creation has always been part of what makes America America. It was the unleashing of the yeoman spirit. I mean, people who couldn't possibly have hoped to inherit land in England, or who came over here and they began to build their own businesses. And the only measure of a man ultimately became one of wealth. I mean, you quote in the book, you know, Tocqueville observing this, all the early observers of America saw that. Could you talk to us about the longer history of the kind of tug of war between the pure expression of democratic spirit in government and the rest of the society engaged in wealth and wealth trying to influence government?
Well, the influence of wealth on government was very strong from the start and was objected to even during the Revolution in places like the old Dutch feudal arrangements of land in the Hudson Valley, in Philadelphia, where the artisans were a political force. There were a few other areas where really they were trying to fight a revolution against economic power at the same time as they were fighting the British. But basically, the revolution against the British was in many ways, on the part of the colonial elites, a revolt against far-off economic power that was trying to control the currency, which the British did, which prohibited things that were done to try to make ironware. The merchants over in London in the eyes of the Virginia tobacco planters, sort of ruined the commerce of that crop because they had a monopoly on it. So the animosities towards concentrations of economic power were there in the beginning. In the Revolution, they were mostly focused on Britain. As soon as the United States was independent and the government had to set up a Bank of the United States and had to deal with questions of debt, the whole issue of so-called papermen, people who were speculators making money with the collusion of some of Alexander Hamilton's friends, became a subject of great annoyance and hostility to the Jeffersonians, and the whole fight in the United States as an independent country came to a boil very quickly with things that are quite akin to what we've been hearing in the last couple of decades.
On point, listeners, we are discussing the history, the political history of the American rich, the conflict between that part of our society which is about creating wealth, getting wealth, and the pure expressions of democracy. We're talking about this with Kevin Phillips, who speaks eloquently on the subject, writes eloquently on the subject in a new book called Wealth and Democracy. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. What was the first great crisis after our independence, Kevin, about this issue?
Well, probably the Bank of the United States and the role that it would play. It was a centerpiece of Alexander Hamilton's blueprint to try to create a commercial and financial elite. And Jefferson didn't sufficiently understand what was coming down. It followed in the footsteps of the Bank of England, which had been set up roughly 100 years earlier as an instrumentality of the Whig Party. And politics and finance were closely related in England, and under Hamilton they became closely related in the United States of the 1790s. That was the first. The Bank of the United States reappeared in a second form 20 years later, and that became a major fight under Jackson. And Jackson vetoed the congressional extension of the second Bank of the United States, and that too bit the dust. Those were two great fights.
When the thing is, of course, that wealth is inevitably going to be part of this society. I you're not saying that there should be cutoff points on how much anyone can accumulate, are you?
Well, there never has been, and even when it was proposed in the 1930s, it wasn't taken seriously. There's no way you can do that. However, one of the things that differentiates different periods in American history is the extent to which they were either periods of private interest, as the Hamiltonian era was and as the last two decades have been, and the Gilded Age, or they were periods of public interest. In the periods of the private interest, essentially the people who were on the make economically were allowed to pretty much get what they could get without contravening regulation or hostile government or attempts to promote a different worldview. In the eras of public interest, the Jeffersonian and the Jacksonian and Lincoln, and in certainly the earlier portion of his of the Republican era then, and then in the progressive period in the New Deal, basically what you saw was attempts to limit the role that wealth could play by controlling its politics, regulating corporations and finance, and setting up taxes, whether they be income taxes or inheritance taxes, that reduced the extent to which wealth could concentrate. And this has been a great interplay in American history.
Mm. How was Lincoln able to restrict the influence of money on political life and government in his time?
Well, people don't sufficiently think of Lincoln in terms of economic policy, but there was a very real underlay of that in his outlook. He was a supporter of labor in the old 19th century sense against capital. Now, capital was thought of as something that was abstract and sitting there in banks and didn't do any work. And to Lincoln, it was the labor that went with the capital when capital worked that was the valuable form of economic activity. And he was a great supporter of the right of workers to strike, even during the Civil War. And as a result, he was not somebody who was setting the pace for capitalism to go bananas as it did after the Civil War.
Kevin,
others did that.
The music means we're coming up to a break. I'm going to hold you right there. Kevin Phillips will join us after the break. And your calls, they're lighting up here on this subject, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking with Kevin Phillips about his new book, Wealth and Democracy, subtitle, A Political History of the American Rich. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. David is calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Good evening, Mr. Ashbrook. Mr. Phillips. Mr. Phillips, I wonder if you could comment on Shays' Rebellion. It occurred, I think it was post-Revolutionary War period, and centered around exactly what you're talking about, the economic disparity that occurred with regard to land distribution and taxation, from what I understand. If you could comment on that, and is there a potential, or have we seen, similar rebellions? And is there the potential to see a similar social uprising that hopefully will not be violent, but seems to accompany these type of
David, you mean an uprising in the present moment with disparity of wealth so great in the United States at this moment?
Correct.
Okay. Kevin?
Well, Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts after the Revolution was from Western Massachusetts. It was an agrarian anger. It wasn't far enough into the larger economic system of the country or the state of Massachusetts to be something that we could draw any great analogy from right now. There was also a whiskey rebellion in Pennsylvania that came in the 1790s, and that was broader based. But frankly, I don't see anything that would be comparable to that today. What would strike me as the vulnerability of the present situation would be if the stock market does another degree of slide and people have reason to worry about their nest eggs and pensions and retirements, if their 401ks become 201ks. You might see some real anger on the part of the public that way, but it's hard for me to imagine that some particular corner of a state is going to revolt in an agrarian sense the way that Shays' Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion took place 200 years ago.
But leaving aside the very specific analogy to Shays and the Whiskey Rebellion, which of course took place almost immediately after the nation had secured its independence, I think that Dave's other question was, you lay out the facts of the case on the wealth disparity in this country, and just wondering why you don't see that this is leading to the kind of simmering anger that in the past, when great concentrations of wealth have separated the rich from the poor by a wide margin, it has created social upheaval.
One of the things that's operating right now that limits that is that there is no major voice in the political system basically focusing these angers and describing exactly the ratios of wealth and who has profited and who hasn't profited. If you don't have that, if you don't have the sort of information about exactly how extreme the gap is, the average person senses that a lot of this has happened, but doesn't have the numbers, doesn't have the sense that this is overwhelming.
Did Ralph Nader not focus that?
I think Ralph Nader focused it only for a very small corner of America. Many people thought he'd get his 5%. He didn't get his 5%. Now, partly that's because the Gore-Bush race was so close. But I think he speaks to a limited portion of American society. If you want to have a revolt of sorts, even if it's an electoral vote, you have to speak to a different portion. Ross Perot, for all the fact that he had a wire that should have gone to an A terminal that went to a B terminal, did speak to the average American. And in 1992, the share of the Americans voting went up from 50% to 55%, all because of him. Now, that's the sort of thing. If we had a Perot talking about this issue now, for all the fact that he's a billionaire, he did have this great line back in 1992, the American people don't have enough money, so I'm going to buy the country back for them. Donald Trump, another billionaire, actually proposed a one-time wealth tax when he was thinking about running for the reform nomination in 2000. Conceivably, somebody could get out there and make all this happen. But the typical Democratic and Republican politicians are too much in need of getting money from the people they'd have to start raising the ruckus about.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jane is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Good evening. Mr. Phillips, I very much am enjoying your book, which I've just gotten partway through. But and I, too, have the sense that we have been at the mercy of great presidents from time to time to rescue us from these accumulations of unevenly distributed wealth. But I don't see any such figure on the horizon. And given our campaign system, financing system, I don't see how a third-party candidate could possibly win an election. And it doesn't seem to be coming from the grassroots. People seem very complacent. So perhaps you could suggest how this could arise.
Well, I don't see anybody on the horizon either. I would say that John McCain in 2000, for all that he was a Republican, had more cutting things to say about the corruption of the election system and the extravagant, almost obscene nature of the tax legislation that his own party was passing. But
is that strictly? Excuse me, Kevin. Is that strictly a question of the function of how much money you actually need to spend to get elected to even something as modest as a seat in the House of Representatives, and that rich people are always more comfortable giving money to others who at least are aware of what big money means, and so you don't find those little populist candidates coming out of nowhere. I mean, as you point out in the book, even Ralph Nader is worth millions of dollars.
Well, what McCain did that was so effective is he called a spade a spade. He referred to the Democrats and Republicans conspiring to sell the country to the highest bidder. That's how he described the campaign financial system. Now, my own view, to come back to it and just restate it, is that I don't think you're going to get public arousal on this, absent politicians talking about it, unless and until there's enough of a problem in the stock market and the economy that people start to get frightened. Now, some are starting to get frightened, I think, now. The last 6 or 8 weeks and the loss of faith in the stock market and the valuation of corporations has moved in this direction. But until you get that, if politicians aren't going to talk about it, you're not going to see anything happen.
Yeah, but then you have the problem of the financial press. Like today, even as we speak, the Dow closed up 300 points, and there's a wave of congratulatory stories sweeping around the 24-hour news networks, popping up at the websites that people check out when they check out what their share prices are worth. And it's hard to see, you know, how you get real information past that.
Well, I'm not sure how you get real information past websites that are being self-congratulatory, but one of the things that I'm sure unnerves the people in Wall Street about what happened today is that obviously you had shorter trading hours and the volume wasn't like what it would normally be, and this often happens on these very light trading days. I don't know why it is, but it's been happening quite a bit in the last couple of years. I even sort of contemplated myself watching the market today because you could buy something at 9:30 and sell it a couple of hours later and do pretty well. Watch it again on Monday. This is not likely to hold on Monday, and we'll see how much unravels.
Let me you know, we've been talking about concentration of wealth. And I'm just wondering if you can be very specific about what you mean by that, because I think a lot of us think, yes, there's a lot of wealth and it comes into the political system via campaign contributions and so on and so forth. But I think what you're talking about is something else again, which is a less direct kind of power.
Well, let's first talk about the magnitude of what's happened. This is something I don't think people realize, so let me lay it out, and it's pretty easy to do. In 1982, Forbes magazine ran its first ever survey of the richest 400 Americans. Of the top 30 individuals and families, you had number 30 had $500 million. Number one, the DuPont family, had $8.6 billion. Now, jump ahead 17 years from 1982 to 1999. Now we're looking at the same top 30, the numbers, 1 through 30, not the same people, not the same individuals or families, but the people in the same positions. Now, number 30 had $7 billion. And number one, Bill Gates, had $85 billion. So what you had was a tenfold increase. Now, the average family, probably most of the people who were listening, maybe they went up ahead of inflation during this period. Probably they did. If they're in the top 1% or 2%, they probably got ahead of inflation by 30, 40%. But I just mentioned a tenfold increase. Now, that's what happened right at the highest levels of American wealth. If you looked at the Forbes 400, the change in their net worth during this period, this is the whole 400, you get almost the same tenfold increase. If you look at what happened to CEOs, the 10 highest compensated CEOs back in 1980 averaged about $3.5 million. By 2001, the 10 highest compensated CEOs averaged $155 million. Now, these numbers need to get out there. People need to know about them. They need to know these were the heights. And the average person, the average family, think of that as just sort of the meandering trough. It didn't go very far. That's what's happened in this country.
Do you think that that's, in a sense, I mean, they would argue, well, this is capitalism and we play by the rules. It's a free market. This is what our market worth is, and therefore we earn this amount of money. Now, you're hardly a socialist. How do you speak to the center or to those who would have been voting Republican 50 years ago and explain that you must put a limit on that kind of earning power?
Well, I'm not saying you have to put a limit on the earning power. You have to make certain that the concentration doesn't develop that way. And when it does develop that way, that you're alert to it and you know the problems that come. Now, let's be quite candid about what that sort of concentration from 1982 to 1999 meant. That is the milieu, that is the psychology in which all these pieces of work in the upper echelons of the Enrons and the WorldComs and the Adelphias and, for all we know, Martha Stewart, all of these people essentially got a sense that in the race for money, in the money culture, cut any corner, distort any profit flow, get your stock up, dump 10,000 employees, get your stock up a little faster. All of this is something that flows from this wealth mentality. Now, this sort of wealth mentality isn't created overnight, but it is created in 10 or 20 years when it feeds on itself. It becomes convinced that it's absolutely the cat's meow, that it's the leading part of America, and whatever they can get, they deserve. That's what creates the sort of thing that's been in the newspapers and on television in the last 6 or 8 weeks. That's how it got there. And it usually does happen after you have one of these booms. You start to see the dirty laundry, all the games that were played as the boom hit its crescendo. But it flows from this wealth worship and these huge concentrations of it.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Dave is on the line.
Hi, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, Dave.
Can you hear me? Mr. Phillips, it was a great honor. I really appreciate your voice in this country. As a Republican, and I hope you're still a Republican, what do you think of these various stakeholder ideas, these ideas of taxing wealth to endow all Americans, every American, with a reasonable amount of money when they start life so that they have their foot in the door economically and they can really participate? You know, if capitalism is good at all, isn't it good for everybody?
Well, I think there's something to that. I'm not exactly certain under what criteria or when the stake would be given out. It's easier to talk about in the abstract than in the actual practice. But I think that that's important. Somehow or other, if capitalism is to maintain its justification, it can't do it with the sort of incredible maldistributions and the arrogance that those maldistributions produce. One thing I'd like to see, I was talking about it with in a magazine interview this morning, and I've started to think about the idea, and I like it more. Why can't shareholders of companies get to pass on CEO pay? Now, the board, its compensation committee, would have to put the amount that they thought was appropriate out there. But I have a funny feeling that if they knew it was going to be voted on by all shareholders, even in proportion to their ownership, they'd be a lot less flamboyant and there'd be a lot less of this piggery. And I think there are lots of things that we can start doing that give capitalism a shareholder and average person face that it's lacked.
Dave, did you have any specific stakeholding ideas that you wanted to bring into the conversation?
I read the book a while back. I can't remember the Yale economist's name that has been developing these ideas. But his basic idea is that we have a wealth tax, a few percent on wealth over a few million dollars, and that money goes to endow people when they turn 21 with $80,000 to get a start in life. He's got all sorts of complicated ways of explaining it. But it seems to me that we need some mechanisms that will develop a constituency for serious wealth redistribution in this country. I mean, a simple idea of my own is that instead of putting all that inheritance tax into general government coffers, that we take that money and divide it equally among everybody turning 21 in a given year.
Kevin, what do you think of that? It sounds kind of noble.
I think to divide it equally among everyone turning 21, a lot of parents would say, why don't we wait until 25 or 26? I don't think my 21-year-old is quite ready for this. And if you look at a lot of their credit cards, maybe that's a pretty good point. I like the ideas in the abstract. How exactly they could be implemented is really another set of problems.
But you are in favor of restoring inheritance taxes that have been rolled back over the last 20 years, because I think you're very concerned about the effect of creating dynasties on American social life, political life as well. And if you have people earning over a period of 20 years these new fortunes, immense fortunes, certainly comparable to the fortunes of the Rockefeller family and the Morgan family at the end of the 19th century, that this could have a destabilizing effect on society.
Oh, I think absolutely. And I do think we have to do a number of things about this. I think one approach, which is very important, would be to get to public financing of elections, because basically that would mean you'd take the wallets of the top 1% off the table, at least to a fair degree. Something else that we should think about, I think of it as sort of the Eisenhower Happy Days tax schedule. Just go back to some of the rate differences that we had under Eisenhower.
Kevin Phillips is talking about Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich. And we'll be taking more of your calls just after the break. And I'd like to talk to Kevin about Empire and Decline. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking about Wealth and Democracy with Kevin Phillips, author of a book of the same name. And the subtitle of that book is A Political History of the American Rich. Kevin, in the book, you broaden out the historical context of wealth and democracy and compare American society today with the two great mercantile empires that existed prior to ours, the British Empire and the Dutch Empire. Now, what is it today that you see in the way wealth is concentrated that you see as comparable to Britain and the Dutch Empire in their era just past their zenith and on their way down?
Well, that's the difficulty. If you look at and I describe it as the financialization of the United States that's occurred over the last 20 or 25 years, when this same sort of thing, which is to say that a country loses its old commitment to making things, growing things, manufacturing things, shipping things, mining things. And when they shift to finance, it's a much more precarious stage. It generally comes when the country has got its, as you say, mercantile empire, its commercial leadership into high gear. And it withdraws from the more mundane things it used to do, like making things, and concentrates on the deals, on the ledgers, on moving money around, and on a related global web of commercial and insurance and shipping services. And nobody lasted very long once they did that, because they became so vulnerable to either a high amount of debt or speculative bubbles, or most of all to being involved in wars that dragged on too long and cost too much. And the British were dragged down by the extent to which their financial system couldn't survive World Wars I and II. The Dutch, and it's a little more complicated, but they too were pulled down by this change they underwent. And if you look at the United States, the financialization has been so extreme in the last 20 years. The so-called fire sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, pulled ahead of manufacturing in the gross domestic product and income numbers in the mid-1990s. People don't realize this. We are well down that road, and the dependence on it is precarious. And actually, even 9/11 underscores that. What was the attack mounted against? First and foremost, the World Trade Center, the financial markets.
But, I mean, the difference, of course, would be that there is, you're probably skeptical about this, there is a world trading order centered in the World Trading Organization, which the U.S., I think, dominates to a considerable degree. And the difference is that much of the manufacturing which has gone away from these shores is, to some degree, more closely connected than perhaps during the British Empire, where the raw materials were being brought to Britain to be manufactured there, as opposed to now, where everything is manufactured offshore and just brought back here for sale.
Well, Britain's industry became less competitive, and they made up for it by the fact that they had so many investments overseas and they sold so many financial and commercial services that they had a net inflow. And the difficulty the United States faces at this point is that our net inflow, that we have a huge debt. I mean, the British were a creditor nation when they started to go down. We're a debtor nation to an enormous degree, almost $2 trillion. We depend on the inflow of stock and bond purchases and direct investments to stay ahead of the game. That may not continue. There are some problems been shaping up in the last couple of weeks. The other, I think, subject for considerable concern is that the Dutch and the British both suffered in their last 20 or 30 years at the top of the heap from what is called now technology transfer. And basically, that's when the technology which gave you your edge starts to get away from you. The extent to which we're at risk for having technology wind up in the hands of the Chinese in Asia by 2025 or 2030 is really quite striking.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Adam is on the line.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was intrigued by your discussion a little bit earlier about the manic nature of the we've got to grow, we've got to make money. And just had a quick comment about that and then a question deriving from that. While it certainly seems to be more manic recently than, as your guest says, perhaps 20 to 30 years ago, isn't that mentality almost an inevitable consequence of growth being the goal rather than sustainability or, you know, maximizing results for the people who are employed by a company, where, you know, growth itself? And with that in mind, I wondered if Mr. Smith has any...
Mr. Phillips.
I beg your pardon. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thinking a different Kevin. if he knows anything and could perhaps discuss alternative capitalist paradigms, I'm specifically thinking of the Mondragon Commune, which is a co-op model in Spain. I wonder if he knows anything about that.
Kevin Phillips.
Well, I don't know enough about that to try to describe it or relate to it, but let me answer what I think is the drift of your point. I think under the the present sort of speculative free market capitalism that the United States has and that the British and the Dutch in some ways had during the same periods. These were all countries that had the speculative urge. They were known for that. And as a result, I think that we do have mania and excitements and the damage that comes from these almost as a matter of inheritance and culture in succession to the Dutch and the British. It's probably going to be a major problem for the United States, and it's almost impossible to get anybody to think that way because the British couldn't get anybody to think that way about the Dutch example, which was a lot closer to them. I don't think that there's any solution in soft forms of capitalism of a sort that I've heard of, whether they be environmentally motivated or sustainability geared. That's not something that the large percentage of the American people relate to. It may be important in parts of California and New England, but don't try it out in Texas or Nebraska or probably Chicago.
But as a kind of alternative Republican yourself now, Kevin, I mean, do you have an ideal sense of the balance between capital, wealth creation, and good democratic governance? How can you achieve it?
Unfortunately, the record is that you need some sort of crisis, or you need, more specifically, a crisis in the markets and in the economy. And the progressive eras, be they under Jefferson or under Jackson or under Teddy Roosevelt or FDR, generally followed some financial crises or very unpopular financial institutions like the banks of the United States with Jefferson and Jackson. I don't think that you can mobilize this sort of reaction around alternative lifestyles. I think anybody who thinks that is probably going to be disillusioned by the reaction of the American electorate as a whole.
Just need to recreate that New Deal majority that was so brilliantly splintered apart in the Nixon White House. Kevin Phillips, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us. Kevin Phillips is the author of Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich, an extremely cogent analysis of where we are today. I want to thank all the callers, and I apologize to those we weren't able to get on the air. In a moment, remembering the splendid splinter. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. Baseball legend Ted Williams died today. He was 83. The Red Sox great was baseball's last 400 hitter, and his career inspired equal measures of devotion and dislike. But all agreed he was one of the best ever to play the game. Author John Updike followed Williams' career, and in a now classic piece for The New Yorker magazine, entitled Hub Fans Bid Kid Adieu, wrote, "The affair between Boston and Ted Williams was no mere summer romance. It was a marriage composed of spats, mutual disappointments, and, toward the end, a mellowing hoard of shattered memories. It fell into three stages, which may be termed youth, maturity, and age, or thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, or Jason, Achilles, and Nestor." Earlier, I asked Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, if he agreed with Updike's quite extraordinary scorecard on Williams.
Well, it certainly suggests that he's worthy of more literary consideration than your average ballplayer, doesn't it?
Yeah. The interesting thing is that when you live this long, you find yourself being eulogized by people who may only fractionally remember you playing live, and even then, when your powers are well past their zenith.
That is a possibility. I think the extraordinary thing about Williams is that as the years go by, more and more and more years now, well over half a century, and nobody else has hit over 400, he becomes bigger and bigger in the eyes and in the imagination, even of those who didn't see him play. People see great hitters not hit 400. I mean, George Brett comes and goes. Wade Boggs comes and goes. Ken Griffey Jr. comes and goes. Ichiro, all of these wonderful hitters who don't do what Williams did. And, of course, the result of that is that even in the eyes and imaginations of people who never saw him play, he becomes bigger and bigger and bigger over the years.
And the argument that that people would launch in favor of saying that George Brett, well, how do we know how great he was? He didn't bat in an era when, as Ted Williams did, when you could have some closer come in to get the last three outs.
Right.
And he wasn't flying across the country and jet-lagged from April until September.
Yeah. Of course, these arguments are impossible to resolve. You can argue that it was harder to hit 406 when Williams did it or that it's harder to do it now. You can argue the quality of the baseball, the quality of pitching, the size of stadiums, all these things come into it. But Williams somehow transcends the arguments just by the size of his achievement and also by the incredible determination. He stated as a young man, I want to be known as the greatest hitter who ever lived. And he made a claim on it. You could argue again, has there ever been a better hitter? He has a claim.
He has a claim on it. It's interesting, we're talking about Williams the hero. And, of course, his era overlapped with Joe DiMaggio.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I could never imagine a song saying, "Where have you gone, Ted Williams? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you." He just wasn't that kind of a guy.
No, and he didn't. He wasn't elegant in the way that DiMaggio was, and he wasn't so image conscious. Joe DiMaggio is famous for being so very conscious of his image, and Williams was too emotional at the beginning to fit that to play that role, to fit that mold. And as the Updike passage that you read suggests, at the beginning, newspaper writers, there were a lot of writers, Dave Egan in particular, who hated him and who vilified him in the press. And there were fans who urged the Red Sox to trade him because he was a nasty guy and he spat and he threw his bat and he, made rude gestures. And then, of course, by the time he was older and certainly after his retirement, he became venerable. He became downright lovable.
And a great outdoorsman.
Mm-hmm.
That's how those of us who were born past a certain point and only caught him
as a fly fisherman.
We saw him as a fly fisherman.
Right. Which some people will say he was the best at that ever lived.
A drive for excellence. It's interesting that you think of hitting a baseball as being something of an enormous, you have to be enormously controlled to be able to both see the ball accurately, anticipate the pitch, see the ball accurately, then swing and actually put the ball where you want it to go. It's a tremendous amount of control, and you don't often think of emotionalism intruding on that.
Well, I think that was one of the more remarkable achievements of Williams, given his personality, because he was a fiery guy. He was a very emotional guy. He had a tremendous capacity for hard work and obviously a terrific capacity for dedication to the task that he'd set himself. But he did have to harness his temper in order to do it as well as he did. And there's no question about it. That was an achievement.
Now, Bill, we've lived long enough and watched baseball long enough to see all the great achievements eclipsed, from Babe Ruth's career record, Hank Aaron did it, the single season record, who knows,
by tomorrow it may have been done again. Right.
Pete Rose getting more hits than anybody else, we watched that happen, 400, will we see it happen ever?
It strikes me, and this is a dangerous thing to say always, but it strikes me that may be a record that lasts, just because we have seen such extraordinary hitters fail to do it. It may be that nobody's going to hit 400 again.
And that's how Ted Williams will be remembered.
Well, Ted Williams will be remembered without any doubt for any number of things, all manner of achievements, but that may be the ultimate memory.
Bill Littlefield, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bill Littlefield is the host of NPR's Only a Game. Ted Williams was 83 years old. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're